Okay, so once again, welcome everyone. It's a great pleasure to have Jason Alicea restart our seminar series this fall. So Jason got his PhD at UCSB, where I first met him. And so for a number of years, he's been a faculty at Caltech, where he is now a full professor. Well, Jason has done a lot of important work, but he is particularly well known for his really seminal work on Majorana fermions, their strategies for their realization in condensed matter, and also their potential use in quantum computing. And so I guess today he's going to tell us about recent developments in this area. In particular, combining Majoranas with this recent, very hot and very interesting topic of twisted bilayer graphene. So please, Jason, you can start.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Anton, for the generous introduction. And thank you very much also for having me here at this remote seminar. So I'll give a talk centered around twisted bilayer graphene. So as many of you have probably heard, over the last few years, twisted bilayer graphene has emerged as a really strikingly rich and tunable platform for strongly correlated quantum many-body physics. I'll propose a way of exploiting that richness and tunability for an enticing long-term application, namely making Majorana-based fault-tolerant qubits. And along the way, I'm going to propose some quote-unquote warm-up experiments that can help shed light on some of the outstanding mysteries of the twisted bilayer graphene phase diagram. This talk will be largely based on this recent preprint posted a few months ago, which was driven in large part by Alex Thompson, also in collaboration with my student Ina Sorensen and experimental colleague and frequent collaborator Stevan Nagypurge. To set the stage, I'm going to begin with a lightning overview of topological quantum computing, which seeks to build scalable qubits that are intrinsically immune to errors. The workhorse of such a topological quantum computer are topological phases of matter that harbor emergent particles called non-abelian anions. Non-abelian anions have many exotic characteristics, one of which is that they necessarily bind unusual zero energy degrees of freedom, the simplest example of which are Majorana zero modes that I will say a bit more about on the previous slide. But for now, if you have some collection of non-abelian anions, those zero energy degrees of freedom that are tethered to those emergent particles span a ground state degeneracy. But this is not an ordinary ground state degeneracy of the type that you might, let's say, encounter in a ferromagnet. Instead, these ground states spanned by non-abelian anions consist of states that are all locally indistinguishable from one another. So if you have some set of degenerate states produced by these non-abelian anions, local measurements don't give you any information about which of those states are actually populated. That property in turn makes non-abelian anions very attractive for quantum information. In particular, quantum information stored in that subspace enjoys intrinsic resilience against local environmental noise. So essentially the same property that makes it difficult for an observer to decipher which of these states your system's populating by performing local measurements also endows those qubits with resilience against local environmental perturbations. So let's imagine now that by some means you initialize your system into one of those degenerate ground states, and let's call it psi sub I, and then take a pair of these non-abelian anions and slowly swap their positions. So these are identical quantum particles, just like bosons and fermions that we all know and love from early on in our physics education. Nevertheless, that exchange does something very non-trivial to your quantum state. So more precisely, that exchange will actually rotate your system non-trivially within that ground state manifold. And that rotation is quantified by a so-called Bray matrix UIJ, which just really specifies exactly how that that swap rotated your quantum state in that subspace. This is the remarkable phenomenon of non-abelian statistics. It's the most exotic kind of quantum statistics that nature allows for as a matter of principle. Importantly, these Braid matrices UIJ are rigid in the sense that their structure doesn't depend on fine details about how you swap those particles, but rather it just depends on global topological properties of that swap. And for quantum information applications, you can view those rigid braid matrices as representing intrinsically fault-tolerant quantum gates that you can apply to your intrinsically fault-tolerant qubit subspace. In a nutshell, this is the idea of topological quantum computing that Alexei Kitaev introduced many years ago. In the years since, this field has been trying to wrestle with the important practical question of how to build the hardware to bring Alexei's vision to experimental life. Roughly 20 years ago now, Alexei provided an important clue to us about how to answer that practical question when he wrote down certainly the very simplest model, theoretical toy model that captures all of this interesting non-abelian anyon phenomenology. So more precisely, in 2001, Alexei Kitaev wrote down what's now commonly called the Kitaev chain Hamiltonian that describes a spinless one-dimensional superconductor. So it's an amazing fact that if you take spinless fermions in one dimension and then gap them out by Cooper pairing, you will get an exotic topological superconducting state that's fully gapped in the interior, but at its endpoints harbors so-called Majorana zero modes. Right? And by virtue of those Majorana zero modes, the endpoints of such a topological superconductor behave like non-abelian anions and exhibit all the interesting non-abelian anion characteristics that I highlighted on the previous slide. So I'm going to denote the operators corresponding to those Majorana zero modes by gamma one and gamma two. Those operators satisfy the important properties shown in this box here. They're Hermitian, they square root of one, they have fermionic anti-commutation relations, and they commute the Hamiltonian. Together, these properties imply that this topological superconductor has a ground state degeneracy. And we can efficiently do the bookkeeping by observing that superimposing gamma one plus I gamma two defines a conventional fermionic operator F that has a zero or one occupation number, just like any ordinary electronic fermion operator. Now, since these gammas commute with the Hamiltonian, so does this F fermion operator. In other words, we can add or remove a fermion from that F level without changing the system's energy, implying the existence of ground state degeneracy. In this particular context, this ground state degeneracy has a very intuitive interpretation. One of those ground states corresponds to a state that has total even number of electrons swimming across that superconductor. You can associate that state with, let's say, the unoccupied state of that fermion. And the other has a total odd number of electrons swimming across that superconductor. And that state corresponds to the state in which that fermion is occupied. So we can actually appreciate intuitively that those states are indeed locally indistinguishable, one of the hallmarks of non-abelian anions. Because if you wanted to know which of those two states your system was populating, you would have to do a non-local measurement that knows simultaneously about gamma one and gamma two so that you could read out the state of that fermionic operator F. Now, if you were to decorate the setup a little bit further, you can imagine having multiple topological superconducting segments that give you more Majorana zero modes that would enlarge your ground state degeneracy accordingly. And by swapping the position of these Majorana zero modes, you will also find the telltale signature of non-abelian statistics. All right, so this it's hard to overstate how elegant this model is. You can literally give this as a homework problem in an advanced condensed matter class and flesh out more or less all of these remarkable and rather exotic characteristics. When it comes to practical realizations, however, this is not trivial, basically because electrons carry spin, whereas you're trying to get something which is effectively spinless. And also, in nearly all superconductors that we know of nowadays, superconductivity arises from the formation of spin singlet Cooper pairs. In other words, we need both spin up and spin down electrons to form superconductivity in just about all known cases. And so there's clearly some tension here between trying to make the system spinless and trying to maintain superconductivity. So nowadays, the good news is that we have many clever schemes that theorists have devised over the last decade or so that provide roadmaps to realizing exactly this kind of topological superconducting state by judiciously combining ingredients that are rather ordinary on their own and already widely understood well understood and widely available in people's labs all across the world. So I'm not going to attempt to give you a complete overview of the different kind of strategies for engineering spinless one-dimensional superconductors. I will, however, just take you through one particularly influential proposal due to these two groups here, including Gil, who's on this call. So in particular, these two papers provided a very appealing roadmap to engineering Majorana zero modes and topological superconductivity in one-dimensional spin orbit coupled wires, for instance, made out of indium antimonide, indium arsenide, or some other heavy element compounds. To illustrate how this proposal works, let's start by building up the ingredients one piece at a time. So let's start by ignoring spin orbit coupling altogether. If you neglect spin orbit coupling, then the minimal band structure corresponds to what I'm showing here. So this is the energy versus momentum relation for electrons in that wire. And then the absence of spin orbit coupling, one can just start from spin degenerate parabolas. So we have two parabolas, one corresponding to spin up, the other corresponding to spin down. Now, when you turn on spin orbit coupling, the spin degeneracy gets partially removed. For instance, the spin up parabola might shift rightwards and the spin down parabola might shift leftwards. So although the spin degeneracy has now been partially removed, one can see that this is still not quite what you want, because it doesn't matter where you park your Fermi level here, you'll still partially occupy both of those bands. And in no sense does your system appear as if it was described by spinless fermions. The beauty of this platform, though, is that you can very easily heal this problem. So by breaking time-versal symmetry with a modest magnetic field, you can open up in a voided level crossing at zero momentum, taking your band structure to something that looks like these blue bands. And now you can see that we're in business, because if you park your chemical potential in that sweet spot, then you have just a single partially occupied band rather than two. And in this important sense, your system now appears effectively spinless. Crucially though, due to spin orbit coupling, this partially occupied band retains some non-trivial spin structure. So for instance, if you look at the right Fermi point here, the electrons there are pointing mostly spin up due to spin orbit coupling, weakly canted by the field. Whereas at the left Fermi point here, again, due to spin orbit coupling, the spins will be mostly pointing down at that momentum, again, weakly canted by the field. So this property, this residual spin structure that appears at the Fermi level, in turn makes this wire easy to make superconducting. So let's imagine that you now drape this wire on an ordinary spin singlet superconductor, for instance, aluminum, niobium, whatever your favorite material might be. In this case, electrons from this wire can tunnel into the spin singlet superconductor and then come back. And those hybridization processes allow the electrons in this wire to inherit properties of that adjacent material via a phenomenon called the proximity effect. So most importantly here, the electrons in the wire will inherit spin singlet superconductivity. And the key thing to observe is that spin singlet super Cooper pairs can still form efficiently because we have both spin up and spin down states available at the Fermi energy to form spin singlets. All right, so as long as your chemical potential resides in that field-induced gap, then you will realize a topological phase with a pair of Majorana zero modes, one at each end. So this was as I mentioned, a highly influential proposal. It very rapidly catalyzed a lot of experimental activity. In the past decade that has followed, there have been many, many experiments along these lines by various groups around the world. Nevertheless, despite the intense experimental activity and lots of resources devoted to this problem, there remains a spirited debate as to the extent to which Majorana zero modes have been stabilized in these sorts of devices. So with the benefit of hindsight, it's useful to reflect a bit on the challenges that one might anticipate facing in realizing this kind of architecture. So I would argue that although the idea of merging materials in this fashion is certainly very powerful, it does open up a potential can of worms. So for one, due to work function mismatch, you might get a high degree of charge transfer from the superconductor to the wire, which in practice can shift your chemical potential far away from where you'd ideally like it to be. Additionally, screening by that superconductor can hamper your ability to gate tune the Fermi level back to the sweet spot in which you'd like it to sit. Another issue is that the interface between these two very different materials can be an important source of disorder. And the fact that you require a magnetic field only makes those disorder effects more pronounced, basically because the magnetic field is fighting against the sensing the superconductivity that's making this whole device operate. Okay, so with those caveats in mind, I'm now going to pivot over to twisted bilayer graphene. And as a teaser, I'm going to propose some architectures that can hopefully allow us to find Majorana zero modes without ever invoking superconducting proximity effects with foreign materials. And if the stars align just right, we might even be able to get Majorana zero modes without even applying a magnetic field. All right, so now let's move to twisted bilayer graphene. So it's useful to start with single layer graphene, which is already a quite remarkable material. Single layer graphene famously hosts this interesting band structure sketched here, which supports massless direct fermions at the so-called K and K prime points at the corners of the Brillouin zone. Sorry. To make twisted bilayer graphene, you have to introduce a second sheet of graphene on top, and then twist one sheet relative to the other. So as you do so, one can see these spectacular so-called moiré patterns forming, the details of which depend very sensitively on the particular twist angle that's been realized. I've stopped this animation at a twist angle of around 1 degree, so you can see that these are ever so slightly twisted relative to each other. That 1 degree twist angle is very special and is commonly called the magic twist angle. So by inspection here, you can see that there's a new so-called moiré unit cell that's formed. That moiré unit cell is a giant object compared to the original graphene unit cell. Its characteristic size is around 10 nanometers and contains thousands of atoms. Now, what makes this twist angle magical is that electrons from, let's say, the K valley in one layer and its rotated counterpart in the other layer hybridize in such a way that produces extremely flat bands in the band structure. And similarly, electrons in the K prime valley hybridize with its rotated partner in the other layer in a way which produces an identical set of extremely flat bands. Now, as a general rule, flat bands are pretty much always interesting in physics, basically because the quenching of kinetic energy can promote other effects that might not otherwise rear their heads so prominently, most strikingly interactions. And perhaps the most famous example of that elevation of interaction effects due to quenching of kinetic energy happens in the context of the quantum Hall effect. Here too, as we'll see, that reduced kinetic energy scale leads to all sorts of interesting physics that strikingly departs from band theory predictions. All right, so let's get more acquainted with the magic angle flat band band structure. So what I'm showing you here is the band structure energies on the vertical axis. The horizontal axis is momentum along various high symmetry directions in the moiré Brillouin zone associated with the giant moiré unit cell. So the bands that are illustrated here were calculated with the famous Bitstrasser-McDonald model. And in the starting configuration, we're well away from the magic angle at roughly 1.5 degrees. So the bands are colored red down up above and down below, and blue in the center. So what I'll now show you is a movie that illustrates how this band structure evolves as we decrease the twist angle from 1.5 degrees down to the magic angle of 1 degree. And the thing to pay attention to in particular is the behavior of these blue bands. All right, so here it goes, decreasing the twist angle. You can see the bandwidth of those blue bands is becoming extremely small. And at 1.05 degrees, it's you can see visually that these bands have been squashed pretty dramatically. Here's a zoom in of those flat bands, exactly the same band structure at 1.05 degree twist angle, just with a much tighter window of energy. Okay, so by inspecting these blue bands here, you can see that they're is a conduction flat band, and there's a valence flat band. Importantly, both the conduction and valence flat bands are fourfold degenerate, so it'll be extremely important to keep in mind for things I say later on. And that fourfold degeneracy arises from a combination of spin and KK prime valley degeneracies. Okay, so once again, valley K electrons in one layer hybridize with the twisted valley K electrons in the other layer, producing one set of flat bands, and the K prime electrons produce an identical set of flat bands. Okay, so that's why there's four. In this inset here, there's a further zoom in of these flat bands. And here you can see that the conduction and valence flat bands meet at massless Dirac ones. So although the band structure has been dramatically rearranged by this twist angle, just like single layer graphene, the system retains massless Dirac fermions in its spectrum. All right, so with this band theory intro, let's now try to anticipate the behavior of the system that you would expect based on just naive band theory predictions. All right, let's suppose that you start with your chemical potential down here between these flat bands and the adjacent dispersive bands down below. So here your system would naturally just behave like a band insulator. As we raise the chemical potential, eventually we'll start to populate those flat bands, giving way to metallic behavior. But once we enter the charge neutrality point at which the chemical potential coincides with these massless Dirac points, that metal becomes a semi-metal with zero density of states at the Fermi energy. Continuing to raise the chemical potential then starts to populate the conduction flat band, reviving metallic behavior before, once again, you enter a band insulator with the flat bands completely filled. All right, so translating that behavior into conductance, here's what you would expect based on band theory for the conductance as a function of carrier density in these flat bands. Okay, so on the far left, this corresponds to the density range in which the flat bands are completely empty. Here you just get a band insulator with zero conductance. As you raise the density, you start to populate those flat bands. The conductance rises, indicating metallic behavior, eventually decreasing again because your system has realized a semi-metallic state. So further increasing the density starts populating the conduction flat band, reviving metallic behavior with increased conductance until eventually you re-enter a band insulator with the flat bands completely full. Okay, so that's, again, naive band theory predictions. Let's now see what experiments have to say. All right, so here are some actual conductance measurements from one of Pablo Herrero Group's Breakthrough 2018 Nature papers. There's two sets of curves here. The red data correspond to zero magnetic field conductance, and the blue corresponds to a small magnetic field of 0.4 Tesla. So roughly, you can see that the conductance more or less follows the behavior of the overall trend expected from band theory, but with certain very striking departures. For instance, there are pronounced conductance dips here, 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 and here in these highlighted regions. So those conductance dips are telling you that band theory is breaking down. These are signaling the onset of correlation-driven insulating states when you have a partial filling of those flat bands. So more precisely, when your flat band, when you have commensurate flat band filling, for instance, half filling of the valence band or half filling of the conduction flat band, interactions give rise to spontaneous symmetry breaking instabilities, whose detailed nature is largely unknown, at least from an experimental standpoint. But what we do know is that those symmetry breaking instabilities are associated with spontaneous rearrangement of the band occupations that you would expect from band theory in such a way that you essentially empty some bands while completely filling others, giving rise to insulating behavior. Incidentally, the mechanism at play is very similar to quantum Hall ferromagnetism, if you're familiar with that in the context of the quantum Hall problem. All right, so this is already quite striking. And perhaps even more interestingly, superconductivity is also present in these samples. So down here, this is a color plot of resistance as a function of temperature along the vertical axis and carrier density along the horizontal axis. And this carrier density window runs between these vertical dashed lines, which sit adjacent to this correlated insulating state at half filling of the valence flat band. All right, so here's the correlated insulating state, and quite amazingly, on both sides of that, one sees superconducting domes. Now, in the relatively short time since these measurements were first published, these measurements have been reproduced and extended by many groups and many different kinds of samples. I'll just show you one other really striking example. So this is also resistance measurements from what's believed to be a particularly clean sample studied from Efetov's group. And here one sees additional superconducting domes and additional correlated insulating states, for instance, at charge neutrality, in addition to half and quarter filling of these flat bands. All right, so this is a quite amazing state of affairs in many ways. One thing I want to highlight here is that we have this platform that allows us to, by relatively modest changes of the density of order 10 to the 12th per centimeter squared, readily tune the system between all sorts of different phases of matter, including band insulators, metallic states, semi-metals, various different kinds of correlated insulating states, and even potentially different kinds of superconductors. So this is really a wonderful gift that nature appears to have given us here. And given this gift, you know, presented with this gift, I think it's very interesting to ask whether we can envision exploiting the richness and tunability that's evident here to start building novel quantum devices. And so that's obviously a very open and broad question. I'm going to more specifically focus on the question of whether we can build novel quantum devices that harbor Majorana zero modes and could eventually be useful for building fault-tolerant qubits. All right, so with that introduction, I can now present to you the big picture that I hope everyone takes away from this talk. In my remaining time, I'm going to be focusing on the behavior of these of the device sketched here, which consists of twisted bilayer graphene. So the red and blue are twisted bilayer graphene sheets. Those twisted bilayer graphene sheets are adjacent to a transition metal dichalcogenide. Please ignore this for now. I'll tell you why that's there shortly. There's going to be a global back gate and a pair of independently tunable top gates. Right, so that trio of gates allows us to separately tune the electron density in the region in between, which I'm going to treat as a gate-defined wire, and the density in the left and right regions adjacent to that gate-defined wire. Here's a simplified overhead view of that device. So we're going to have, once again, a gate-defined wire in the center immersed between bulk phases, bulk phase one on the left and bulk phase two on the right end. So the physics that you should have in your mind here is that the wave function for those gate-defined wire states, they bleed to some degree into those adjacent bulk phases. That in turn allows those gate-defined wire electrons to hybridize with the bulk phases adjacent to it. And those gate-defined wire electrons will in turn inherit properties of those adjacent phases via internal, what I'll call internal proximity effects, to be distinguished from the kind of external proximity effects that I showed you earlier arising from the merger of disparate materials. Right, so all of this is happening within just a gateable twisted bilayer graphene device. Okay, so now the basic idea is that we can, by choosing different kinds of bulk phases to immerse this wire in, we can tailor the electronic properties of that gate-defined wire for interesting directions. And as you might imagine, we have a lot of flexibility for tailoring the properties of the wire because there's so many different kinds of bulk phases available to us in a single twisted bilayer graphene sample. All right, so more specifically, what I'm going to do in the next several slides is exploit these kind of structures for two closely related purposes. One, I'm going to use this gate-defined wire to propose electrical probes of subtle symmetry breaking order that's native to those adjacent bulk phases. All right, so this will give us a way of electrically detecting, for instance, atomic scale symmetry breaking order that might be very difficult to detect otherwise. And then I'll get to the main purpose of this talk, which is to propose closely related structures that are useful for Majorana engineering. Okay, so the rest is basically details of filling in how we reach those conclusions. All right, so let's start with the simplest possible gate-defined wire structure that you can imagine. In particular, let's take a gate-defined wire and immerse it between just trivial band insulators on the left and right. So to realize this kind of structure, you can imagine that on the left and right side, the chemical potential sits below the bottom of the flat band between the flat band and the adjacent dispersive bands, producing just band insulation. So that happens on the outer regions of this device. But to get some metallic states in the central gate-defined wire region, we can start to populate, we can gate-tune the density to start to populate some of the bottommost states in those flat bands. All right, so the minimal band structure for that gate-defined wire is sketched here. So this is the energy versus momentum. And here's where it's really essential to recall that there's a fourfold degeneracy of these flat bands because we have both spin and valley. So instead of just having two parabolas, now we have to start with four parabolas. So the red parabolas here correspond to valley K electrons. We have one parabola for spin up and one parabola for spin down. And the blue corresponds to K prime electrons, again, with spin up and spin down parabolas. Now you might wonder actually why these K and K prime electrons are not sitting on top of each other. There's nothing like spin orbit coupling that's been injected here. Basically, the fact that these K and K prime parabolas are offset is a consequence of rotation symmetry breaking in this gate-defined wire geometry. And so this is really a generic feature of this band structure. All right, so the starting from this trivial wire, we can now see that we have some challenge ahead of us if we're going to use this system for Majorana engineering. Because in order to get a Majorana platform here, we have to open up a spinless regime for this gate-defined wire. But that requires not only removing spin degeneracies, but also valley degeneracy. And that's a non-trivial thing to do, as I'll describe later on. So I'm going to attack the removal of these two types of degeneracy separately, beginning with the removal of spin degeneracy. So first of all, the existence of spin degeneracy has an intuitive physical origin. This whole system so far is just made out of light carbon atoms, which have negligible spin orbit coupling. And therefore, spin is just a spectator quantum number that we just attach to all of our bands. That means if we want to remove the spin degeneracy, then we have to figure out how to inject spin orbit coupling into twisted bilayer graphene. Fortunately, this has indeed already been demonstrated. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about this recent joint theory experimental paper led by Stefan Nagy-Perge, which studied twisted bilayer graphene samples adjacent to tungsten diselenide. Okay, so tungsten diselenide features very heavy elements and exhibits very strong spin orbit coupling accordingly. When you put these two systems into contact with each other, electrons from the twisted bilayer graphene can tunnel into tungsten diselenide and then come back. And due to those hybridization processes, you might naturally expect that the carbon atoms will inherit some of the strong spin orbit coupling from that native substrate, from that adjacent substrate. Consistent with that intuitive picture, along with various experiments on related graphene tungsten diselenide devices, this paper found that twisted bilayer graphene inherits milli electron volt scale spin orbit coupling from tungsten diselenide. So there was complementary evidence reported for this finding. One had to do with the lambda level spectrum and the corresponding pattern of quantum Hall states that were observed, which indicated splitting of the lambda level degeneracy compared to what you would expect in the absence of spin orbit coupling. And the more direct evidence came from weak anti-localization measurements. All right. But again, you know, you might not have been skeptical about this conclusion even without this evidence, because we had lots of experiments that indicated that this should have happened even before you do the experiment. What's less obvious, however, is whether the richness of the twisted bilayer graphene phase diagram that I showed you earlier survives in the presence of tungsten diselenide. And there's at least two things that you might worry about here. So first, you might worry that maybe tungsten diselenide is a significant source of disorder. Maybe it produces strain and other non-idealities that tend to muddy some of the features that were prominent in pure twisted bilayer phase, in pure twisted bilayer graphene. A second thing you might worry about is that maybe spin orbit coupling just suppresses some of the interesting phases that were observed experimentally. For instance, you know, maybe destroying superconductivity or some of these correlated insulating states. So fortunately, neither of those worries turn out to be realized in practice. And the answer to this question is emphatically yes. So here's some experimental data illustrating that point. So the color is once again resistance as a function of temperature and carrier density, flat band carrier density. In this upper panel, this corresponds to a device close to the magic angle, around 1 degree twist angle. And one can see very prominent correlated insulating states, maybe a little bit less so here, along with superconductivity manifesting in the phase diagram. Now, interestingly, when you decrease the twist angle, the correlated insulating states are rapidly washed out. And that's something you can actually understand from as a consequence of band theory. Essentially, the gap between the flat and dispersive bands closes as you decrease the twist angle. And that tends to wash out the existence of correlated insulating states. But interestingly, superconductivity persists. Right? So here's a measurement for 0.87 degree twist angle. There's not really any strongly visible correlated insulating states, but there is a manifest superconducting dome. And even further away from the twist, the magic twist angle, here's 0.79 degrees. You see a superconducting dome persisting there as well. Now, this is striking because if you were going to study twisted bilayer graphene without tungsten diselenide, superconductivity requires a much tighter window of twist angles close to the magic angle. Okay, so evidently, what we're seeing here is that tungsten diselenide allows superconductivity persist over a much broader window of twist angles compared to pure twisted bilayer graphene samples. So one important conclusion that we can take away from these measurements is that not only does superconductivity in twisted bilayer graphene survive this tungsten diselenide substrate and spin orbit coupling, but it appears to thrive in the presence of those ingredients. All right, so let me get back to this device I showed you earlier. I mentioned that there is this transition metal dicalcogenide, which I asked you to previously ignore. We can now see why that's there. It's there solely to impart spin orbit coupling into the twisted bilayer graphene sheets. All right, so let's revisit our trivial wire, gate-defined wire immersed between band insulators, now turning on spin orbit coupling imparted by this tungsten diselenide substrate. So this spin degeneracy will now be lifted, leading to a band structure that now looks something like this. Okay, so the red bands still represent K electrons, and the blue bands still represent K prime electrons, but we can no longer simply append a spin label to those bands. All right, so this we've removed some of our degeneracy, but you can still see that we're not quite where we want to be. Same problem as I mentioned earlier arises in this context, namely wherever you park your Fermi level here, you'll always be occupying at least these two bands, and so in no sense does your system appear spinless for any chemical potential window. All right, so if we want to open up a spinless regime, we have to figure out how to lift these crossings between K and K prime bands here and here. So this is a tricky, this is where things start to get a little bit tricky. In order to lift that crossing, we have to engender scattering, coherent scattering between electrons from the K and K prime valence. And that requires a very large momentum transfer all the way across the original microscopic graphene Brillouin zone. Equivalently, that requires ultra short scale modulations to be able to mediate that large momentum transfer. This is, I think, the conceptually hardest part of this problem. When we first tried to fix this problem, we went along various false steps. For instance, we thought, well, maybe if you have certain orientations for your gate-defined wire relative to the underlying moiré super lattice, maybe there's special orientations for which you automatically get KK prime scattering. That turned out to not go anywhere. Next thing we tried is to think about introducing very short range impurities, maybe atomic scale magnetic impurities, do break time reversal symmetry, and also scatter K and K prime electrons. That also was not a very appealing idea. But at some point we came to the realization that we were trying to force this in too intentionally, and that there was actually a more efficient way to go. Namely, we could try to rely on the richness of the twisted bilayer graphene phase diagram to basically do all the hard work for us. So what I'm going to describe next is a scenario where instead of immersing this gate-defined wire between band insulators, if we immerse that gate-defined wire between a particular kind of correlated insulating state, then we can automatically produce these coherent KK prime scattering processes. All right, so earlier I mentioned offhand that the nature detailed nature of correlated insulating states in twisted bilayer graphene remains a largely experimentally open question. But theorists have of course gone to town and studied that problem quite a bit. Now, for at least some of the observed correlated insulating states, namely at charge neutrality and half filling of the conduction and valence flat bands, theory predicts a particular class of correlated insulating states that exhibit the interesting phenomenon of intervalley coherence. Okay, so in an intervalley coherent correlated insulator, interactions spontaneously generate coherent tunneling between electrons in the K and K prime valleys. So there are a variety of theory papers that address this question in complementary ways, mostly centered around Hartree-Fock type techniques. More recently, there's been a pair of works from mostly from the Oxford group, along with Berkeley, that propose that in the presence of realistic levels of strain, there can be yet additional kind of intervalley coherent correlated insulating states that that can also appear prevalently in the twisted bilayer graphene phase diagram. Okay, so this is very appealing because intervalley coherence generates exactly the same kind of KK prime tunneling processes that we need to open up a spinless regime inner wire. Now, as an interesting aside, topological defects in those intervalley coherent correlated insulating states have been proposed to provide a novel mechanism for superconductivity observed adjacent to those correlated insulating states. So I think this proposed mechanism provides a lot of motivation for trying to nail down the existence of intervalley coherent order in experiment, even apart from the motivations that I have for Myron engineering. All right, so let's now imagine parking our gate-defined wire not between band insulators, but between intervalley coherent correlated insulating states on both ends. Okay, so because of internal proximity effects of the type I mentioned earlier, the gate-defined wire electrons will soak up some of that intervalley coherent order, yielding coherent tunneling between K and K prime electrons that allow those crossings to now indeed be lifted as desired.
Can I ask a quick question, Jason?
Yes, please, Anton.
So what is the microscopic symmetry that requires these crossings to be there?
Do you mean without intervalley coherence?
Yeah.
So there, you know, to a very good approximation, there's a U1 valley conservation symmetry, which is the order one culprit. Now, there's also time reversal symmetry, which I will turn to in a moment, that dictates that if your system preserves time reversal symmetry, even if you allow for coherent scattering between K and K prime valleys, then you can still get a crossing here, which is not due to valley conservation, but instead just due to Cromer's degeneracy.
Okay.
So it has, you know, ultimately it descends from the high degree of decoupling between the K and K prime electrons in the twisted bilayer graphene.
Okay, but so it's an exact symmetry. It's not.
It's not an exact symmetry technically. You know, I think if you turn on interactions, it becomes something like a Z3 symmetry. But I think, you know, to a very good approximation, the symmetry is there.
Okay.
And, you know, I think there's quite a bit of experimental evidence for that as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Sure. All right. So these crossings can now be lifted, which is exactly what we wanted to figure out how to do. Now, a subtlety that I now need to invoke, related to Anton's question, actually, is that there's not a single kind of intervalley coherent correlated insulator. There are different families of intervalley coherent correlated insulating states. And the important thing that I want to emphasize now is that there's a dichotomy in the sense that some intervalley coherent correlated insulators break time reversal symmetry spontaneously and others preserve time reversal symmetry. So if you your intervalley coherent correlated insulator spontaneously breaks time reversal symmetry, then these crossings will immediately be lifted, producing the kind of band structure that you see here, indicated by these blue lines. And notice in particular that there's a gap here and here in the spectrum. And when your Fermi level sits inside of the, let's say, this lower gap, you have a single partially occupied band, which is what we wanted to achieve. And now it may be that your intervalley coherent state preserves time reversal symmetry. In that case, your band structure will look like what I've drawn here, and it still features those crossings at zero momentum. Right? And as I just mentioned in response to Anton's question, in this case, that crossing simply exists because of Cromer's degeneracy. It's guaranteed by time reversal symmetry. It doesn't mean we haven't gained anything. We actually have gained quite a bit here by utilizing intervalley coherent order, because now by simply breaking time reversal symmetry, for instance, with a magnetic field, we can lift those crossings producing the single channel regimes that we desire. All right, so at this point, I want to strongly emphasize that the existence of these gap openings here and here owe their existence entirely to intervalley coherence. If those, if you didn't have intervalley coherence, these gaps categorically could not arise. So now we could actually try to turn this problem on its head a bit and try to use the existence of these gaps here and here as an electrical probe of intervalley coherent order in an adjacent correlated insulating state. All right, so here's how we envision electrically detecting intervalley coherence using these gate-defined wire geometries. So these three band structures here are the same band structures that, that I sketched on the previous slide. Below each one, I'm now additionally showing the conductance as a function of chemical potential. Okay, so let's focus on this left plot where we had we considered an intervalley coherent state that spontaneously breaks time-versal symmetry, opening up gaps here and here in the spectrum. So if we go to the very left of this conductance plot, that corresponds to having the chemical potential below the band bottom. And since you have no states at the Fermi level, the conductance will just be zero. As you raise the chemical potential, eventually you your chemical potential sits somewhere here, and you have two sets of right movers, one here, and two sets of left movers. Okay, so correspondingly in the ballistic limit, you'll get a jump from zero to 2e squared over h in the conductance. But when you raise the chemical potential further, at some point you enter a regime where you just have a single pair of right and left movers rather than two, and that manifests as a precipitous drop in the conductance. And that precipitous drop in the conductance would not arise without having opened up this gap. Okay, without this gap, you would still have two right and left moving modes, and therefore you just continue to get 2e squared over h conductance. And similarly over here, in this case where we had to open up where we had to use a magnetic field to open up a gap, you would once again get non-monotonic conductance. You would get these conductance dips signaling the opening of these crossings, which again, you know, require an intervalley coherence to mediate. All right, so the upshot is that these conductance dips that are mediated by intervalley coherence can be used as a large-scale electrical signature of ultra-short-scale symmetry breaking order that exists microscopically in that kind of state. So I think this would be a very cool experiment if it can successfully be done, even apart from applications in Majorana engineering. One thing that gives me a bit of hope that this experiment is actually feasible is that related experiments have actually been done in both wires in gallium arsenide and also indium antimonide. So in these more conventional wires that were studied in these previous setups, one resolved conductance dips, very much like what we're searching for here, that require an interplay between spin orbit coupling and Zeeman physics. Okay, the mechanism at work is very similar in our twisted bilayer graphene wires, with the crucial addition that in order to get those dips, you need additionally intervalley coherence. Okay, so at this point, we now have all the ingredients that we need to propose a concrete device that hosts Majorana zero modes. Suppose now that we park our gate-defined wire between an intervalley coherent insulator, correlated insulator on one side, but on the other side, instead of having another intervalley coherent correlated insulator, we can modestly gate tune the system into a superconducting state. Now, the nature of superconductivity in twisted bilayer graphene is also unclear at this point. I'm going to make the assumption that it's kind of boring in the sense that it's fully gapped and pairs time reverse partners. But really, the most important thing is that it's fully gapped. If it's gapless, then this won't work. All right, so I'm also going to allow for the possibility of adding magnetic field, which we may need in the case of the situation where IVC, where this intervalley coherent order preserves time-versal symmetry, or maybe we even want to, in the case where time-versal symmetry is broken spontaneously, to broaden band gaps for us. So we've studied these gate-defined wires using some very phenomenological model to just establish basic proof of concept. So these color plots down below represent phase diagrams established by those phenomenological models. This left phase diagram corresponds to the situation in which the intervalley coherent order spontaneously breaks time-versal symmetry. And on the right corresponds to the situation where the intervalley coherent order preserves time versus symmetry. All right, so the axes here, I have chemical potential for our wire on the vertical axis and the Zeeman energy from that applied magnetic field on the horizontal axis. Okay, so the details are not that important. The thing I want to draw your attention to are the presence of these topological phases labeled by topo. Those are topological superconducting states with Majorana zero modes. We see them both in the left phase diagram and also a little pocket in the right phase diagram. And maybe the most enticing feature here in these phase diagrams is visible on this left plot here, where this topological phase actually persists all the way down to exactly zero magnetic field, basically because time versus symmetry is already broken spontaneously by intervalley coherent order. Okay, so these wires, as advertised in my teaser earlier, provide us with the tantalizing prospect of getting topological superconductivity without ever invoking external proximity effects with foreign materials, and possibly also even in the absence of a magnetic field. Okay, so if one or both of those features are actually observed experimentally, that could be, I hope, a real game changer for this enterprise. All right, so let me see how I'm doing on time. Okay, so I think I'm hopefully okay time-wise. Let me end with a short outlook. So I've proposed these gate-defined wire architectures for two complementary purposes. First, as an electrical diagnostic of intervalley coherent order. Because intervalley coherent order has been proposed to underlie the origin of superconductivity, these kinds of devices might also shed some light on the, at least indirectly, on the nature of Cooper pairing in twisted bilayer graphing. And at the very end, I hopefully establish these devices also as a promising platform for Majorana-based topological qubits. So let me just highlight some of the virtues here, but not all of which I've touched on earlier in this talk. So I think twisted bilayer graphene and related architectures really benefit from exquisite gate tunability, almost unrivaled in any platform, at least that I'm aware of. I think it's a huge virtue that there are no external superconducting proximity effects required in these devices. Again, you know, the possible operation at zero magnetic field could also be an extremely desirable feature. Combining exquisite gate tunability and the lack of external superconducting proximity effects allows the absence of external superconducting proximity effects allows for real-time control over patterning of phases in these kinds of devices, which could be very useful for, let's say, defining qubits, multiple qubits inside of a single sample. In terms of probes, these kind of platforms are amenable to a wide variety of experimental techniques, including transport local probes like STM, local compressibility measurements, and so on. And finally, you know, looking more forward, one can incorporate mesoscopic effects into these kinds of geometries that take advantage of charging energies. And those effects have been shown to be essential for qubit operation and related settings. Of course, there are challenges that I'm fully aware of, and I hope I'm not too much of a pie in the sky theorist. The critical temperature for superconductivity is actually not that high. It's of order a Kelvin or so. I'm actually less worried about this issue than I have been previously. In fact, there's an experimental paper that is set to appear this evening from Stefan Nagypurge. That shows that actually, despite the relatively low critical temperatures, at least in twisted trilayer graphene, closely related system, the actual gaps are substantially larger. And I think the gap is more important than the critical temperature. Disorder in sample-to-sample variations, those are important things that are going to need to be figured out in order to make this practical. And of course, all this rests on intervalley coherent order, which is not yet confirmed experimentally. But I hope, once again, that these settings can try to provide evidence for that intervalley coherent order. Prospects for this area, I believe, are also quite exciting if you think beyond twisted bilayer graphene. Most strikingly, I think twisted trilayer graphene has emerged as yet another stunningly rich and tunable platform, which has, among other virtues, a more robust superconductivity in terms of higher TC, higher gaps, and also a high magnetic field tolerance. And of course, there is a variety of other Moiré materials, other in addition, that one can contemplate for these kind of directions. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Jason, for a very nice and very clear talk. So any questions? So please unmute yourself and ask. So Kartiek, please go ahead.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for the nice talk. Can I just ask why intervalley order is expected in this case, as opposed to just electrons filling up a single valley? Is there a simple, like in bilayer quantum Hall, it's very simple to understand. You just want to distribute charge equally between two layers. In this case, what's the intuition?
Well, I don't know if I have, a one sentence intuition. I mean, I can tell you that one profitable way of attacking this problem theoretically is to go to the limit where the flat bands are actually completely flat. Then one can, you can actually start with some controlled framework, and then try to, let's say, put in effects like residual kinetic energy. And, in that framework, one sees that intervalley coherent states tend to dominate. And, complementary Hartree-Fock simulations that don't attack that flat band limit, but, directly attack the original dispersive problem, reach basically the same conclusion. Now, it's possible that, that somebody who has actually worked on the detailed modeling of those of the phase diagram, using those Hartree-Fock techniques, they might be able to give you a, kind of cartoon explanation for why that is, but I currently don't have such a picture.
Okay, thanks, Jason.
So Chandra, please go ahead.
Hi, I have a question which is not directly pertaining to your talk, but more generally, is there some progress in how to detect Majoranas?
Yes. So I think there, in terms of how to detect them, there's a laundry list of possible ideas that have been proposed theoretically. I can comment a little bit about my own personal take on this aspect of the problem. I think transport, NS spectroscopy has gotten somewhat of an unfair bad name in this area, following all the uncertainty with transport measurements that have been carried out in the nanowire, proximitized nanowire context. My feeling is that there are additional features that one can try to probe with conventional transport beyond just seeing the existence of a zero bias peak. So I think the zero bias peak, has been by far the most common signature which people have latched onto, which has lots of unfortunate aspects to in terms of being a smoking gun. But importantly, if you're able to tune between, let's say, a trivial and topological phase in some controlled way, then in addition to seeing a zero bias peak, you should also ideally see the evidence of a phase transition, meaning the gap closing and reopening. And so for whatever reason, that gap closing and reopening tends to not be observed, maybe because one just hasn't crossed that phase transition and hasn't actually succeeded in getting the topological phase, or maybe disorder effects can kind of muddy that transition. But I still think that, when you're confronted with a new platform, for instance, like the one I'm proposing here, the first thing you'd like to do is try to use transport, not make things too complicated initially, and see if you can finally resolve the onset of that phase transition, which I think would make this, there'd be no debate if you saw gap closure, reopening, and then zero bias peak left behind once the gap opening occurred. Now, of course, that you don't want to stop there. There's various techniques for, let's say, detecting not only the existence of Majorana zero modes, but also states, quantum states encoded in Majorana zero modes. And this can be done in a wide variety of ways, ranging from interferometry to charge sensing. So maybe I can leave it at that, but happy to elaborate if you want more information.
experimentally this interferometry, has it borne any fruit so far?
No. So yeah, it remains an unfulfilled prediction. But I do think, you know, in terms of if you actually can get a reliable topological phase, it, you know, to me, it seems like one of the most appealing tools to try to develop, because, you know, it allows you to perform not only pairwise Majorana measurements, but actually multi-Majorana measurements.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, Ahmed, go ahead.
Hi, I have a rather simple question about the band structure of the wire when you have like two trivial insulators.
Okay.
And the effect of spin orbit coupling was to a cavity. Yeah, so you had the effect of spin orbit coupling was to, in each value, was to raise the spin up and down in energy, like raise the spin up in energy and spin down would go down in energy, which was different than the effect of spin orbit coupling in the case that you showed earlier for the 1D wire, like they were separated in momentum. Like, I wonder why this didn't happen in that case.
Well, you know, I think, okay, so a few comments I can make here. You shouldn't necessarily think about the upper band being spin up and the lower band being spin down. In general, you can't even label an entire band by spin quantum number. There can be some non-trivial spin texture. You also shouldn't take too literally the idea that these parabolas are just moving vertically. That is it's the easiest thing for me to try to animate in Keynote, but you know they could be rearranged in a variety of ways. But what I can say is that certain generic features. Sorry, let me continue to show you this. Spin orbit band structure. So the generic features are basically that, this should be reflection symmetric, and that's a consequence of time reversal symmetry and, whatever. So basically time reversal symmetry is the key thing that you need to impose here. And, you could move around these bands in a variety of ways that are still compatible with time reversal symmetry and value conservation. So yeah, I apologize for the overly simplistic impression I gave about these band structures.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Can I ask a simple question? So Jason, you had this great idea of 1D wire network to braid the Majorana fermions. So there you were like turning on and turning off the superconducting parts of the structure. So with this, this one is a little different, right? Because you are not using proximity effect, the superconductor. So can you still play the same trick, you think?
Yeah, so the answer is definitely yes. So in terms of the qualitative features of what's going on, we are still using a superconducting proximity effect, but just in without slapping on a foreign material. So if you want to envision that kind of gate-tuned transport of Majorana zero modes, you could imagine having not just a single gate across this wire, but maybe multiple gates. And by controlling in real time where the chemical potential sits adjacent to a given wire, for instance, are you in the single channel regime or an even channel regime, you can similarly imagine in real time controlling which parts of your wire are topological and which parts are trivial. In fact, I would say that this is a far more optimal setting in which to carry that out, because you don't have any. I think the ability to gate tune this wire here has basically no obstructions, whereas in the proximitized wire case, you're really fighting against strong screening by the superconductor.
Oh yeah, that's right. Okay, I see. Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions? Well, I actually had another question. So. Will your proposal work if the superconductor is, due to condensation or topological defects? in the intervalley coherent insulator?
Yeah, so you know, I think that's an interesting question. That's I'm you know 99% confident that the answer is yes. You know, this proposal is kind of agnostic as to the mechanisms of superconductivity as long as it's there and fully gapped. So fully gapped is essential. You know, there could be certain, I think there is a regime here that hasn't been really fleshed out theoretically though. And again, you know, I'm going to do another teaser for the paper from Stefan set to appear later today, which suggests that actually at least in twisted trilayer graphene, at least in some window of density, you realize a very interesting kind of BEC-like or you know strong pairing, depending on your terminology taste, superconducting state that actually has some kind of nodal character to the order parameter, but nevertheless, because it's like it's a BEC kind of superconducting state, you don't have any gapless excitations. And you know that strikes me as an interesting kind of setting to really dive in and understand the nuances of proximity effect that could arise there. I don't anticipate any issues, but maybe there's at least important quantitative things to understand.
I see, thank you.
Sure.
So any more questions? Well, if not, let's thank Jason again for a really nice talk. It's a great way to restart our seminar series. And well, we'll see you again next week, I guess.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.